Without further ado, let's go to Connor. Bring him in. Connor, are you there?
I am, Jake. How are you?
I'm doing super duper. I'm glad for this day to be over. No more stupid commercials and no more stupid signs and ugh.
Well, you know, we threw away our TV about 5-6 years ago, and it's been wonderful ever since. I haven't seen a single campaign commercial. It's been just blissful.
Yeah, good on you. So the Electoral College, right? Basically, electors are chosen at the state convention for whatever party. Depending on who wins the popular vote, that state then gets to have their electors weigh in. Is that fair?
Well, so think of it like the World Series, right? At the end of however many games are played, I don't even know, but, you know, there's a succession of games that are played, and the winning team is not the team that scored the most home runs or whatever throughout the entire process, all tallied up in one aggregate vote. The winning team is the one that has won the most games. And that's kind of how it works with the Electoral College. Is it the popular vote? It's not a simple majority vote with however many Americans vote for candidate A or candidate B, C, or D. It's how many states have been won. It's a state-based election.
Right. And so Utah will go for Romney, so we know the electoral vote will go to Romney.
Right. So each party has
their
electors.
The popular vote, meaning, will go to Romney.
Correct. So each state has their electors, the Democrat Party, Republican Party, I guess you guys do as well, Libertarian Party.
Yep.
And when the popular vote goes for Romney, then the electors from the Republican Party are the ones that then cast the vote in favor of Romney, effectively.
Yep.
So it's really, they're bound to the popular vote. The popular vote is the deciding factor, but it's done at a more local state level, where each state's electors then are apportioned to go to whoever that candidate is that their state has ended up voting for.
And the electors are elected either at state convention, or they are chosen by the executive committee of their respective parties.
Sure, depends on the party, right? Yeah, each party can have different functions. In the Republican Party, they're elected at the state convention. And so it's kind of a weird, many people think it's an antiquated system, but it's yet another buffer put in place by the founders, who detested democracy and did not want a simple appeal to the masses.
Yeah, they didn't want the majority vote type of deal.
Right, and, you know, it's interesting. I mean, so each state gets a certain amount of electors. Each state is allocated the number of electors that's equal to its senators plus its representatives. So in Utah, with the census being redone, we now have 4 congressional districts plus the 2 senators, so we get 6 electoral college votes. And so as the population increases, as they redivide and redistribute all the votes, that number will change across different states when redistricting is done. But it compels the candidates to actually campaign and go out and talk to and discuss and, you know, of course, in theory, listen to the concerns of Americans who are quite different in different geographical areas. Whereas if they could just blanket the airwaves and stay in D.C. or whatever and try and win the popular vote and not actually do boots-on-the-ground campaigning with all this diverse population, it would be a far different thing, and they would just fundraise and spend money and try and, you know, push propaganda, which, of course, is what they do. But it's at least one more little buffer put in where it's a very state-based effort, which is why, of course, now you get so much all the talk is Ohio, right, which way Ohio goes, and that's
or Colorado, and it's these states that they're more populated.
They're more populated, so there's more votes there, and they're contested states. There's a chance that it could go either way based on get-out-the-vote efforts. So, you know, you've got your locks like California and New York for the Democrat Party, Texas, for example, a very large state with a lot of congressional districts and therefore electors, very heavily Republican. And so, you know, these states aren't as much of a clinch, and when you're calculating which way the Electoral College vote is going to end up, these ones are sure, but then the focus becomes on those battleground states where there's a lot of electors to capture, which translate into a lot of Americans, right? Because if it's based on congressional districts, that means there's a certain population density there, so there's a lot of Americans, a lot of votes to be had. And so it is confusing. Many people think it's antiquated and want to do away with it, but in asking for that, they are explicitly, in fact, asking to infuse yet more democracy into the American system of government that its founders never intended to be there. The Electoral College serves an important purpose. You know, of course, many people are confused about it because who in the world was taught about it in public school, you know? And so there's a lot of confusion about it. There needs to be more education to restore the notion that this is yet one more piece of having a republic over democracy that the founders intended to put in place. It was not intended to be confusing or soon antiquated. It is a way by which this federalism can exist within this system of governance that we have.
So that brings us kind of to your topic today.
More or less. You know, it's hard not to talk about the election today, right? I mean, that's what's going on. It's what's on everyone's mind.
It's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. You got signs on the street. You got people talking on everywhere.
Facebook ads. And, yep. Yeah, I mean, of course it's on our attention. So I wrote a post on my blog this morning, ConnorBoyack.com, where I basically made the case that, you know, elections are not the way to go. And by that I mean they are not the end-all, be-all solution to restoring liberty and the Constitution and fixing all of America's problems. And, you know, I'll get into it more. We're probably hitting up against a break. I'll get into this more on the other side of the break.
We've got about 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. So this really gets boiled down to an interesting contest, personality battle during the founding era between John Adams and Tom Paine, right? Two both well-respected, well-known men in the founding era who in more or less detested one another, and not perhaps personally, but definitely their avenues of activism, the methods by which they advocated for the things that they believed in. John Adams really did not like Tom Paine. He criticized him. He wrote all these letters saying he completely disagreed with him. He later in life conceded the point that it was Tom Paine's writings that really made revolution possible and created that popular upswell for going against the king. But John Adams did not like Tom Paine because he saw Tom Paine as a figure that simply wanted to tear things down, right? He was saying, down with the king and let's dismantle this government and all of these abuses. And it was a tearing down process that John Adams thought Tom Paine was advocating for. And he was right. What John Adams was worried about is that Tom Paine did not sufficiently understand, nor did the American public at large, what to build up in its place. Right, so here you have this Tom Paine figure tearing things down, but John Adams was exceedingly worried about what would be built up in place. He called it a change of impostors, the threat of substituting one form of clowns for another. Right, you get rid of a king, and then you get a king here, or a despot, or a democratic government, or what have you. Why switch out tyranny? Why spend so much money and time and lives to effectively replace the tyrant? And so John Adams was exceedingly worried about what Tom Paine's efforts would do by simply tearing down because there were so few people who knew how to build up. And that is kind of the segue that I want to talk more about on the other side of the segment in the context of elections today, that there's so much focus on tearing down and defeating the other guy, the whole lesser of two evils, that at least, you know, Romney's not as bad as Obama, and we need to defeat the other guy. We need to, you know, get the Democrats out of power, or whatever the context of the conversation is. The conversation today has become effectively what John Adams was worried about in his day with Tom Paine, and that is there are so many voices calling for tearing down the government, and rightly so. I mean, of course, the government is hugely tyrannical now, and so we need to talk about more about building up, and that's what I want to talk about on the flip side.
All right, come on back, guys. All right, guys, we're back. Mental self-defense in the middle of the Boyack Review. Let's go to Connor. Hey, Connor, are you still there?
I am, sir.
All right, we got a caller. Let me bring him in real quick.
Sounds good.
Caller, you're on the air. What's your name?
As usual, Craig.
Hi, Craig. What's up?
Listen, the young lady that called earlier.
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of moved on, but yeah.
Tell me about these things.
All right. I didn't say that. I said shill.
Oh, shill. Okay.
Yeah, and you're on the radio, dude, so
okay,
get it together.
Okay, I'll go for the shill part.
Yeah, get it together. You're on the radio.
Okay, I'll be for the shill.
Yeah, dude,
but
that's two strikes already.
I just want to let you know that there was a lot of Republicans that have been... What was the guy that was caught on Second South? There was a congressman.
I don't care. Make your point, because I'm, like, so close to hanging up on you. I'm so disgusted with you right now. But I'm giving you your chance.
Hey,
make good.
You still want my vote for Gary Johnson?
I can
give
a crap
about you. I have not gone to the voting
booth
yet.
Craig, I could care less. You got 10 seconds. I'm not joking, and now I'm hanging up. Go.
I just wanted you to know that it is not fake, and that the court case you're talking about...
Dude,
and,
okay, you know
Andy
what?
Andy McAuliffe won $1.
Listen, bye-bye, Craig, because the fact that you just told me that you put somebody up to that and you're a proven shill, man, done. All right, sorry, Connor, I just, you know, these people are ridiculous.
A little bit of background I have no clue about. Sounds fun.
Some anonymous person who wouldn't give their name said that Andy McCullough happens to date strippers. He's a single man. I can't see anything illegal happening. In fact, he works with people in that field quite often. It makes sense that he might do it. But I've known him for years, and I can't say I've ever seen it. It doesn't matter, though. Heck, that's what rock stars do in my world. So whatever, people. I mean, and Craig, you're a polite guy, you're nice, but I've had it with you, man. That you could be nice, but if you're a dirtbag like that, and then you go and cuss like that on radio on my show, bye. All right, Connor, sorry.
I'm going to tie this back into what I'm talking about. There was a... I haven't seen if it was proven true or not, but we know it happens all the time. I saw the other day this 30-second surveillance camera footage of a guy taking down Mia Love signs. And, in fact, my mom has been on the city council for about a decade, and when I was a teenager, she ran unsuccessfully for the first time, and I was accused by one of her opponents, her main opponent, for tearing down her signs in broad daylight on the busiest intersection of our city at 3 in the afternoon with a hoodie and a baseball bat.
There's no proof that it's you.
It didn't happen. They bring me before my bishop. They were trying to rattle on me and get me in trouble. I did not do it at all. My parents knew I didn't do it because, I'm a smart... I was a teenager. I was a little bit of a rebellious punk from time to time. But I was a smart kid.
As most good libertarians are.
And if I was going to do that, which I didn't, but if I was going to do it, I would do it 3 in the morning, not 3 in the afternoon. I mean, cut me some slack, right? And yet, that happens all the time. We know it does. People get signs stolen and all this intrigue and all this stuff like this caller's talking about. Politics is dirty. And this actually dovetails very nicely with what I talked about in this morning's post, that when you get this centralization of power, it becomes a popularity contest for people to try and wrest control of that power, right?
Sure.
It's like this jackpot. It's like the lottery. The bigger it gets, the more people want to play and try and win it for themselves, because you're not just winning $100, you can win $100 million. When political power is centralized, when there's significant power to be had by winning an election, winning a popularity contest, there's going to be a lot more crap that goes on in an effort to try and, do whatever it takes. I mean, look this morning in the voter fraud.
Everything people hate about high school.
It is. Politics is a high school popularity contest, right? People promising free lunches and better soda machines.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And, but it's such a good metaphor for what politics is. And so in this morning's post, I say, this is the problem with the centralization of power. And too many people think that the way to fight centralized power is to just dive right in and try and wrest control of it. And that's not to say there isn't a place for that. You ran against Chaffetz. We've got other good candidates running for office. I supported Mike Lee a couple years ago.
Yeah, and we both support Ron Paul. But I think something that's important here, notice the people we're supporting are using the political system as a didactic measure to teach people, not to win necessarily. I mean, you could win because that's the risk you take getting involved in this stuff. But... But it's to spread the ideas because you get a bigger bullhorn.
And that's a good point. I mean, you look at, I love how Tom Wood says it, and I'm going to paraphrase, but it's like, a decade from now, no one's going to remember the philosophical contribution and movement of Rick Santorum, right? No one's going to think like, oh, the lasting ideas that Rick Santorum had. Look at how he shaped the Republican Party, or look at how he shaped, the Liberty Movement in America. These guys are all irrelevant.
Yeah.
Even a Mitt Romney, even a Barack Obama, there's no significant contribution. There's no lasting movement, right? It's just fickle. It comes, it goes. They get their power, they use it and abuse it, and then they move on, and the next imposter gets in. And then you've got someone like a Ron Paul or, some of these liberty types that, maybe they're not in it to actually reduce the size and scope of government, although they try and they should. But maybe they're in it just to educate and persuade, to use the bully pulpit, the bullhorn, and try and advocate for more liberty. And I loved, I don't know if you were able to attend this, but Ron Paul came to Utah just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I had a business engagement. I really wanted to go.
It was fantastic. You can find it on, it's at UVU. You can find it on YouTube. A bunch of people posted clips. He couched almost the entirety of his remarks in the context of the subject of personal responsibility.
Brilliant.
It wasn't, here are all these bad laws, and we need to endorse and support this guy and this guy and this guy to overturn this legislation, or we need to go support this bill. None of that existed in his conversation. He was encouraging people to change themselves, to talk to their neighbors, to persuade those in their sphere of influence, to create a resurgence of responsibility as kind of this paramount objective for a healthy society, that it begins with you and I. And that was really the crux of what I was saying in this blog post this morning, is that there is so much attention today and for the past months, years, on this election, and it happens again and again and again. We start all over, and as soon as this election ends, people are going to start, you know, chest thumping for the 2016 election and positioning themselves and all this. There's far too much focus and time and money spent and political capital expended on elections. And elections do not bring the lasting change that we in the Liberty Movement want. And I think that's the problem, is that far too many in our movement, and of course, definitely generally in the American public, people think that elections will bring about actual change. When you look at the past several decades, again, let's just look at the presidential office, no matter which party has been involved, no matter how much limited government or big government they promised, the trend has remained consistent with only very minor deviations. Government continues to grow. Big, you know, government programs have continued to be created and expanded. There is no reversing of that trend, no matter who was in office and what initial they had past their name. Our efforts, I think, need to be far more fundamental. I love, in my church, in the Mormon church, there's a scripture that I love in the book called The Doctrine and Covenants, where we are commanded by God to, quote, waste and wear out our lives exposing hidden things of darkness. And I like that because it's an education-based, it's a persuasive, it's a very active effort to highlight corruption, not necessarily to say, therefore, let's fight against it and take these guys down in this Tom Paine sense, but being aware of the problems is the first part before we can actually try and correct the problem, right? People can't live liberty and live independent and live free if they don't first understand what these things are, if they don't understand, you know, what bondage they're in, if they don't see the contrast between serving the state, you know, and serving God or serving their own passions, their pursuit of happiness.
This is one thing that I find interesting because, you know, clearly you and I have different upbringings with regards to religion, all that kind of stuff. But I think you and I share very similar values, despite that most people think all values are about religion. Well, I don't think it's necessarily that way, or some people come to it. But anyway, for me, it has nothing to do with religion. And it's very much to what you said and that you're saying in your new book and that Ron Paul said, one of my big heroes, Thomas Szasz, has always said that individual responsibility and individual liberty are inextricably tied. They're the same thing. And also I like the fact that you're bringing up the point that this battle ultimately is one of education. How do we wake people up, turn people on to these ideas?
And you know, it's too easy for people to be swayed by political figures. Maybe it's identity politics, right? You look at like a Mia Love, how she's taking away the woman vote from Matheson, who's long enjoyed the woman vote. Well, these women are voting for a fellow woman. That's not lasting political change. That's not understanding
that's
what liberty is. It's sexism, or you get racism with Obama, you know, or whatever. You get this identity politics. With elections, it's far more focused on the person than the principle. It's more focused on the policies, and not even that. So often it's focused just on the person, the personality. Elections are a distraction, ultimately, because people feel that they've fulfilled their civic duty. They've done their job. They can be a good patriotic American because they got their sticker, right? They went and voted. And they can proudly display that on their chest until they change clothing the next day. And then, sure, maybe they'll watch news and they'll chat about it over dinner from time to time. But you don't see any consistent and successive activism after the ballot box is done, after people vote and go home. You know, with exceptions. This is a very general statement. But by and large, you see Americans think, have this mentality that going to vote is the way that they can restore this country and turn this around and save us from this fiscal cliff, when that's not the case at all. There are so many entrenched forces in Washington, D.C., that even if Mitt Romney, for example, won and was sincere in his effort to scale back the debt and the deficit, he may be sincere. I don't think he would be able to do it. And even if he wanted to do it,
well,
I don't think he could do it.
His track record, just looking to Massachusetts, is absolutely abysmal.
And so even accepting all of these, taking these things for granted that he would in fact do this, the opposition is so overwhelming that I simply don't know that it could be done. I think the change that we need, changing Washington, D.C., has to be a bottom-up effort. You know, the founders, for example, when they realized that they could not change Parliament, that they could not get representation in there and get the reforms
right.
they needed, they quickly realized they had to opt out completely. They seceded. They revolted. And that's not to say that we need, you know, of course, a revolution, a violent one, let alone a violent
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I agree, right.
But we need the education. And what's interesting is I don't know that we're there, right? Back in the day, you at least had this core group of Americans who understood liberty, who were very receptive to the message of Tom Paine. And you've got a burgeoning liberty movement in our day, but there are far too few who recognize the importance of liberty and, more importantly, are willing to live it, are willing to opt out of government programs, are willing to, you know, do whatever it takes to stick committed to their principles. And I think the problem that we have is that there's so much attention and effort expended on things related to liberty, in the sense that let's go to this rally to fight against this law, or let's, you know, do this
activity.
Yeah,
or people going to city council meetings and this, that, and the other thing. I mean, what, I don't mean to interrupt, but I think I really agree with you. I think the thing to keep in mind, because this is what, I'm anti-political. Like, City Weekly gave me the biggest compliment. They called me an anti-politician. Like, I mean, that's like the greatest compliment I could ever possibly get. And people wonder, well, why are you involved with politics and blah, blah, blah? Why would you bother with Libertarian Party? They suck. Because think about it. Think about this in your own life. How did you come to these ideas? Especially all the baby libertarians. It was Ron Paul who ran for an elected office. But he didn't win. But he wasn't winning that battle. He won the war of ideas. That is the important thing. And I actually think that we're heading towards an opportunity, like you were mentioning with the founders. I see this fiscal cliff. You know, I put that peg a date at 2025. That is going to be our chance to secede, actually. And it's exciting because all the young people will be in those positions of influence by 2025. We could have a brand new chance, a bottom-up.
You've got so many people reading all these crazy libertarian or classical literature tomes, right? I mean, looking at young people I know reading The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Right.
Understanding the world as it is far better than so many or people when, you know, when I was younger, when I was in high school or early in college. My concern is that there is so much effort in the liberty movement generally about opposing government, taking the Tom Paine approach and saying, let's down with this law, down with this program. And we need that. That's important. I don't want to diminish that at all. I do it myself. But if we don't have the John Adams side in knowing what to build up in place of tearing down, and knowing what proposals to make that are appealing, that are beneficial, that are long-lasting, that can actually work to replace the tyranny when we hopefully are finally able to pull it down, we need to have this combined effort of liberty and responsibility. We need to be building not only institutions up and things to compete with the state and provide charity and do all this, but we need to build ourselves up. We need to be responsible. We need to live. How can we claim that we want independence and freedom if we are not living independently, if we are in, for example, financial bondage? You know, this is why my book just came out this week, Latter-day Responsibility, and it's such an important message. I call it the prequel to my first book. People keep saying, oh, this is the sequel. But responsibility precedes liberty, right? My first book was, let's look at what liberty is, what the government shouldn't be doing. But this is a step back. We all need to take a step back.
That's the story of the boomer tea partiers. They want liberty without responsibility. You can't have it that way.
And perhaps many of these people are responsible. They are living that way, but they don't see the connection between the two.
Well,
and that's why I'm hopeful this book will get more popular.
If you're a tea partier and you're encouraging Social Security and Medicaid, I might argue that... Anyway, hey,
again.
great segment, Connor. Thanks,
Jake.
Man. All right, we'll see you guys tomorrow. No more.